The participants and friends of the 27th Annual Liturgical Conference, my comrades and brothers, all in the great human adventure to which the people of God have been assigned, my insecurity pattern is such that I cannot, with any degree of authenticity, suggest that I am glad to be here. I'm just downright unglad to be anywhere where I have to speak. But since a man of faith is assigned to be delighted, to be in any situation the Lord is assigned to him, then if he cannot in the first immediacy be glad to be somewhere, he jolly well has to in the second immediacy be glad to be there. And that means he has to decide to be glad to be there. And that means that he has to decide why he's going to decide that he's glad to be there. And I've been reflecting upon this, being as insecure as I am. And I've decided to be glad to be here because I have decided that in the midst of the wonders that delineate Century 20, that Vatican II may very well be remembered as the signal event of that century. But I do not mean just what happened at Rome by Vatican II. That was but the beginning. And what a beginning it was. The gates are open and no one shall shut them. But what I mean by Vatican II is the task that now remains. In taking what happened in Rome and finally incarnating it in the thought and the life and the work of the local parishes throughout the globe. That shall finally be Vatican II. And I am convinced that it is the intent of this conference to contribute to that overwhelming task that now has to be done. I am an unabashed revolutionary in the Church of Jesus Christ. But even I am somewhat overwhelmed by the boldness of the theme of this conference, Worship in the City of Man. And methinks that that theme and the titles of the addresses that have been published indicate that those who are part of this conference really mean to come to the naked heart of the matter relative to the renewal of the liturgy in the 20th century. It's somewhere in that area that I find myself quite able and willing to decide to be a part of this conference. For there is no renewal of the church from where I stand, save there is a renewal of the symbolic aspect of human existence, which the liturgy is concerned with, and there is no renewal of that symbolic aspect of human existence unless we come to terms with the actualities of the world in which we live. Now, I have been asked to talk upon the peace of Christ in the modern city, and I want to spend most of my time on that modern city, the city of man. But mark you well that the modern city is not a geographical isness. It is not a coagulation of souls. It is not even to be defined by the structures that constitute the new form of human settlement. The modern city is a mindset, is a spirit aspect of man in the 20th century, and some way or another we have to probe to the bottom of that, and only when we do, it seems to me, can we talk relevantly about the peace Christ in our time. Certainly, the historians down the road are going to look back upon our time and describe it with some such radical category as a mutation in humanness. Nothing less than that, which is to say that what it meant to be a human being up to this revolutionary hour was one thing, and what it means to be a human being after this hour shall be something quite different. I call this revolution that you and I are a part of, a cultural revolution, to point to the fact that it touches the very wellsprings of humanness itself, down underneath those aspects of human existence that we call the economic or the political. And very concretely, this revolution is first of all a radical alteration in common sense that has come in and through the scientific revolution. And secondly, it is a radical alteration in human settlement or human style or the structures in and through which human beings relate to one another. And thirdly, and most importantly, and where I want to center my attention, the cultural revolution of our hour is a revolution I'd like to use the word religion here, but that word has been so misused that I think we ought to hang it out on a clothesline to dry for about 100 years. And therefore, I'm somewhat hard put for terminology. Sometimes I call it a moodalistic revolution, an alteration in human mood. I mean an alteration in those metaphors in and through which man is present to the raw encounter of consciousness that defines humanness itself. And the name that has been given to this aspect of the cultural revolution is the secular revolution. And I want to see if maybe we can't get somewhere near the bottom of what we mean when we talk about the secular revolution. And I want to do that, and this is a sociological, not a religious or theological analysis. I want to do that through the basic categories of the primordial encounter in humanness, the primordial response in humanness in the 20th century, the primordial conflict in humanness, and the primordial certitude in humanness. But in order to get a hold of this, I've got to paint somewhat of a large picture. Let's say that you and I are living at the end of the period of Neolithic man. How long has it been now? 10,000 years or is it 20,000 years? Be that as it may, Kenneth Boulding calls this the period of civilization and says now it's come to an end and you and I are living in post-civilization. Anyway, toward the end of the Neolithic period, that is to say, about the 8th to the 4th century BC, something rather fantastic broke loose in the civilizing process. And I mean that the operating metaphor in and through which men were present to the raw encounter in consciousness itself was finally forged, made overt in rather an amazing sense. And this happened in many places at once. It happened among the Hebrew people. It happened among the Greek people. It happened in India. It happened in China. I do not want to press this point, but it would not surprise me at all when we learn more about the history of the great civilizations in Africa before we pinkies rape that continent, that we'll discover that something like that might have happened in Africa. And perhaps even when we learn more about the Mayan civilization, that we'll discover something on the order of this happened there also. Be that as it may, the metaphor that was forged in and through which man was enabled to be present to his experience of the raw encounter in life, I call it the classical metaphor, became clear. And now that metaphor, which served us well and in the Middle Ages was filled full in a rather a fantastic fashion, has now come to an end. And a brand new metaphor is being forged. And instead of calling that the classical metaphor of religion, if you please, we call this the secular metaphor. And if you you're to understand modern man, secular man, urban man, man in the city of today, you have to understand that unbelievable shift in metaphors in and through which man is present to the very core of humanness itself. Now, let me talk about that primordial encounter. In the great classical image, we encountered that encounter, if you'll allow that kind of a statement, at the edge. In the secular metaphor, we encounter that encounter at the very center of it all. That is to say, in the way you and I learned to talk about religion, we spoke of the fundamental encounter in terms of the over and above and the beyond. That is, at the edge of our contingency, at the edge of our creatureliness, we met the ultimate, so to speak. Perhaps so that you won't get this mixed up with your theologizing, I'll just use Plato as an illustration. You remember that he was quite well aware of that world, I always make a sort of a zigzag here, the realm of change, the realm of the unexpected, the realm of you don't know what the devil is going to happen next, the realm of getting born, the realm of getting died, the realm of history, if you please. He was quite clear about this everyday going onness of life, but he also was clear about something else, that as you move between the no longer and the not yet, if you stopped to think and mark you in terms of that understanding of rationality, you stop and think. That is to say, you think backwards. And when you stop and think, this going onness that constitutes the everydayness of life stops. You're over against the changeless, the cosmos, the once and for all, the eternal. Now, you and I know about that. But the existential problem, the salvation problem, if you please, of the Greeks was which one of those two worlds was going to be the really, 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 I mean really, 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 real? And every Greek play that was ever written was written on that theme as to whether or not this everydayness of change and unexpectedness, was going to be the real, or whether that once and for allness that was present when you stopped to think was real. And the Greeks made their decision that the really, really, really real was that which was at the edge of the everyday going onness that constitutes human existence. That's what I mean by the classical metaphor. That is to say, if now I may use a theological category, God is up there. You understand? That was the two-story universe. And then, in our time, what a time to live. That metaphor, by whatever brings metaphors to be and yanks them out of being, was yanked out of being forever and forever and forever and forever and forever. Is that enough? And forever. There's no going back. It was a glorious metaphor. You don't have to beat it over the head. When you do not see the glory of it, all you're saying is you're still trapped by it. It's like two boys in the same family. One knuckles under Papa, and the other one rebels. But he has to hang on to Papa's lapel while he kicks him in the shins. They're sleeping in the same bed. You can see the glory and the value, the usefulness in terms of humanness of that great metaphor, and then see its past. And now, whatever that final mysterious going onness behind everything that is, that brings metaphors to be, is bringing the secular metaphor into being. And that is the metaphor of a one-story universe. The second story is now gone. What a glorious metaphor, don't forget. But now it's gone forever. Oh, we were so frightened, were we not? Hey, you remember when we felt that second story oozing away? We used to talk of the secular as if it was some nasty old monster, hey, that was destroying us. We even began to use that term negatively, huh? But then a strangeness has happened. Exactly when man has become utterly, and I said utterly, one story, totally human, absolutely secular to the raw core, he has discovered a transparency occurs. I can't use the word transcendent yet, for we still hang that on to the second story. And an awkward term, though it may be, I call it a transparency, where the awe is oozing through. I mean the dread that frightens us so and the fascination that lures us the more. The awe is oozing through at the heart of the matter, at the bottom of it all, at the very center of the secular. One of the great ironies of our time, and I think that's the right word, perhaps double irony, is the death of God boys. I call them the romper boys. And I call them the romper boys on two counts. I used to share platforms with them some 10 and some of them 20 years ago. And in those days, when it was relevant to announce the death of God, do you understand that? The passing of the classical metaphor. These men were scared to death and tried to hang on to a naive Bardianism, to yank them out of the predicament of having to become secular men. 20 years later, that naive Bardianism collapsed for them, and now they are bearing their manly bosoms, announcing that God is dead 20 years after it has significant meaning. And the second part of that irony is that exactly when they are announcing God is dead, my God, God is being born again. I mean the God who dies himself. The God who dies himself and borns himself anew is borning himself in our time. Now, hark ye well, not in terms, of the class, that's antiquated piosity now, but I mean God is born. The awe is seeping through at the center of it all. You know, there are always prophets come too lately, who... You know, 20 years ago, we had many metaphors. The silence of God, the remoteness of God, the hiddenness of God. But none of these poetic metaphors were powerful enough to announce the collapse of the classical metaphor. Only God is dead. But the prophets come too lately. When you have nothing to risk, for everybody and his brother who is halfway sensitive knows that God is dead. But the prophets come too lately, are fighting their battles here when now the war is way out there somewhere. But when I say God is being born, I do not mean that there's anything simply ethereal about this. I mean something very concretely. And the man in the street is aware of this. I think that you and I should think again about the fact that those of us who are the professionally religious are usually the last ones to know that God is being born again. And I'm talking about the man out in the street. He may not know the name, but he's aware of the reality. And the first way, it seems to me, in the 20th century, that man is encountering the raw encounter at the center of it all is in terms of the impingement of the inclusive upon the parochial. Did you hear that? That's where the awe is seeping through. I mean that experience at the very center of life that rips you loose from your little reductionistic stances in life and yanks you out into a broader breathing space. You see, Vatican II was a response to the activity of God in the midst of the secular world, breaking Rome loose into glorious universes she had up to this time never dreamed of. And some of us who were Protestants were hanging on the coattails, and we got a whiff of the divine activity too. I'd like to illustrate this in many ways. Here I am, a pinky. You know, my friends in the Negro ghetto insist that it's not white. But you see, I only discovered the basket case I was. You see, we white people had cut off the red man. We'd cut off the yellow man. We'd cut off the brown man. We'd cut off the black man. A basket case, pretending that we were full human beings, and more than that, that we were the very epitome of what human beings ought to be. And then those black people began to look at us, and we experienced the transparency at the center, and that ripping us loose into broader worlds in which to breathe. That's the divine activity as man in the 20th century experiences it. The second way he experiences it is in terms of the impingement of the futuri upon our propensity to live in the securities of yesterday. Did you get that figure? I mean, the divine activity is that activity in the midst of everyday life that grips you by the shoulders and tears you loose from your securities and about you faces and propels you into the unknownedness of the not yet. And do you not understand that the secular man, and I mean that the one who is not a professional religious lay or cleric, is exactly... is exactly the one who understands the transparency at the center. And the third thing that I would talk about, the fashion in which the man on the street is experiencing the raw encounter of consciousness, is in terms of the impingement of the utterly intentional upon our propensity to be globs or to be slobs or to simply ooze through life. That is to say, that activity that finally calls you by name. My name is Joseph. Not very many people call me Joseph. My mother used to at times, and my wife does yet at times. And every time they call me Joseph, I feel guilty immediately. I know I've done something I shouldn't do. And the reason for it, that's who I am, Joseph. And I'm the only, I always look upon anybody else who has that name as a usurper. My name is Joseph. That points to the unrepeatable isness that I am. And that going onness in the midst of everyday life that addresses me. You know, it took little old Samuel 3 hearings before it finally got through his skull that was the Lord calling him to attention. The term Joseph means that I stand to attention and assume responsibility for writing the script of history itself. That's the divine activity. That's the transparency at the core. That's the point at which the awe is seeping through. And the man on the street, and the man in the factory, and the man in the laboratory, and the man in the university, though he may not know the name, is aware of the birth of God, of the raw encounter at the bottom of life. But I've got to hurry. My time is passing. And I want to now talk about the primordial response to that primordial encounter as secular man experiences it. Back in the classical image, the response was the reproducing of eternal patterns. the reproducing of eternal. That is to say, there were essences up here. And that is to say that man had an essence. That is to say, there was a human nature. And man's task was to catch a vision of that essence, that nature, and then spend his life attempting to reproduce that pattern. And you see, this is the way men worked. As a matter of fact, the fights that went on were in the same bed under the same pair of sheets. That is to say, the quarrel was over who had the best way of getting a hold of the image, or who had the best image of what man was that he was to reproduce. Some said that it came through the process of ratiocination. Others said that it came through direct intellectual intuition. Others saw it more of an emotional, intuitive experience. And some thought that it came through certain sacred bodies of people. And others thought that it came out of little black books with gold edges around the leaf that came down out of heaven that disclosed to man what the proper image was. Now, you do not separate where I began with the encounter with what I'm saying now. That's what it meant to be moral. And now, in the secular image, no longer is it a matter of reproducing eternal patterns, but it's a matter of creating temporal models that define the future. Did you follow that carefully? To be a secular man, or what we mean by a secular man, is the man who assumes responsibility for taking the clues of the trends and putting a rational pattern upon them, including indeterminacies which shall alter the trends themselves or create the future. And what this means in practice, don't you talk to this kind of a man about being a moral man unless you are busy out on the very edge of the civilizing process between the no longer and the not yet, and there laying down your life on behalf of mankind to bring a more adequate grasp of humanness in depth and in scope. That's the secular response. And the third thing that I want to talk about . Yes, if you were a group of Methodists, I'm a lowly Methodist, I would want to talk about that morality is not a matter of not getting drunk or not sleeping with the next door neighbor's wife. Morality in the secular world is a matter of laying down your life to change civilization. The third aspect of getting hold upon secularity has to do with what I call the primordial conflict. When you followed what I've said up to now, then you begin to understand the deep spirit conflict in life, the struggle to live before that transparency and to be the one who responds in assuming responsibility for the play of mankind itself. And in the past, in the classical image, these powers that we struggled with were seen as natural powers. Now, I do not mean simply the animism that was in Africa. No. I mean in United States of America. Take, for instance, Freud. Man's primitive conflict was a struggle with external forces and internal powers. Do you understand? As a matter of fact, in Chicago, certain social workers are still operating on the idea that the so-called juvenile delinquents are victims of external environment or early home conditioning. And you ought to smile at that just a little bit. That's what I mean by the antiquated classical metaphor that defines humanness. In terms of the secular metaphor, man is not the victim of anything. That is to say, the powers he struggles with are historical powers, not natural powers. How shall I illustrate that quickly? If I allow my wife to determine my life, it's not because she's my wife that she has that power. It's because I could not face handling my to rule my life over to my wife. That's what I mean by the powers being historical. If I allow the Methodist Church to rule my existence, it's not because she's the Methodist Church. It's because I didn't have guts enough to handle my own life and therefore placed it into the hands of that which was unsynonymous with myself. But once you give your mother, or once you give your wife or any other agency the power to rule your life, you're caught in a demonic struggle. This is to say that man today understands just as clearly as we ever did in the past the struggle with the demons. The point of it is the demons are of our own making. They are historical and they are not natural. I sometimes have used the illustration to take a Freudian category that if any man is castrated by his wife, he is only castrated because he gave the scissors to her to castrate him. And this you and I need to understand in terms of the deep struggle to be human beings in the midst of our age. And my last category is that of certitude. You see, again, if you follow this step by step, finally you almost hit the bottom of consciousness itself with the screaming question of certitude. And in the classical image, certitude was a matter of authority. Whenever you deal with ideas about life rather than life as the basic reality, then your basic question of assurance or certitude is a matter of authority. Who says so? And in our day, that's gone forever and forever. To say Paul Tillich, he say so, becomes ridiculous because the worms are eating his ashes and lucid man sees that. To say Thomas Aquinas, he say so, becomes ridiculous, because Thomas was a creature that passed with all of us. To say the Bible, it say so, is the same kind of a problem, because the Bible puts the question and does not give the answer. I mean, you have to decide. And in the secular metaphor, the matter of certitude for that man on the street, and you know the word, it's authenticity. Now, how can you roughly and quickly dramatize what authenticity means? It's something like this. In the midst of the everydayness of my life, I have to make a decision. And in the midst of that situation, when I take a big leap down to the end, that's to that 6-foot hole in the ground, mine, and in my imagination, with my toes, I'm standing on the edge of it all. You got that figure, have you? Then you see your life not as a million and one decisions and not as a million and one actions, but as one decision and as one great deed. You understand that in authenticity, I do not do many things. I am an act. I am an impact on history. And when you stand there in lucid awareness that you go around the clock once, not twice, just once, not twice, you have to decide, and you decide alone. My friend Luther, long time ago, in one of his sermons, said, when you got born, I was not there. When you get died, I'll not be there. When I got born, you were not there. And when I get died, you'll not be there. Every man has got to do his own getting born and his own getting died alone. And that means that you and I decide. Nobody can decide for us. For even if I decide to allow you to decide, I decided to allow you rather than you to decide. Every man decides alone how he's going to go around that clock. That's what it means to be a man in the 20th century. And the little key to this is that when you've seen what I've described, then your decision of authenticity is to be the utterly inclusive, the utterly futuric, and the utterly intentional man. Now, we've used this term, the secular revolution, loosely, too long. We've got to understand that it's a religious revolution and that it has to do with the basic deeps of humanness itself.
Now, one final word, and I'm through. You can only in our day raise the question of the peace of Christ when you understand the kind of a world that God has given us to live in. And the peace of Christ is always the absurdity of the incarnation and the absurdity of the crucifixion. That is to say, the absurdity of God being in Christ, the absurdity of God being in man. And to put that into the 20th century means that the meaning of life, and hark you, today I'm suggesting we know more about the meaning of the incarnation than our fathers ever did. The absurdity of the incarnation is that the deep meaning of life is in the givenness of life. And if you're to talk about the peace of Christ in the modern city, in the world of man, then you're going to talk about it in terms of the absurdity of picking up your life as it is given to you and live it. That is to be secular man in the givenness of our secularity, as our fathers were religious men in terms of that classical metaphor to the hilt. That's the absurdity of the incarnation and the peace that is in Jesus Christ. And yet this absurdity of the incarnation is never, never divorced from the absurdity of the crucifixion. And the absurdity of the crucifixion is that you pick up the one life you have and give it, expend it, on behalf of the modern city. That is, on behalf of all men, on behalf of secular man. That's the peace that is in Christ in the modern city. And my last word has to do with the liturgy. Whatever course the liturgy may finally take, what today it seems to me we are clear about is that you do not meet God in that activity of worship, but you are recollected under the awareness in that act of worship that it's God that you meet out in the midst of the everyday going onness of your life. And that awareness is brought to consciousness as the blessed incarnation and crucifixion is dramatized before the eyes of mankind and in the deeps of their heart, in and through the service of liturgy. If modern man is to be man, he's going to have to engage in the play that gives him cosmic permission to live his life and to die his death in the only world that he knows anything about, which is the world that God has given to him in our time. And I pray for this conference that you have the courage to move on into the deeps of that bold theme. For remember well, you're not doing it simply on behalf of yourselves. You're doing it on behalf of the whole body of Jesus Christ, and therefore on behalf of every man and all of creation itself. And I'm through.